This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
True North stores have Primo Eats and Pepsi brand products that are heavy on taste and light on your wallet. Right now, buy any Primo sandwich and add a 20-ounce Pepsi brand beverage for just $1. Handmade every day, Primo uses quality meats and cheeses. Complete the meal with a Pepsi. Grab any Primo sandwich and pair it with a 20-ounce Pepsi brand beverage for just $1. Get more with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your app store. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Do you know about the true crimes that inspired a Bruce Springsteen album? Or the murders AC/DC was blamed for? How about Taylor Swift's violent stalkers? Or the suspicious deaths of Brittany Murphy and River Phoenix? These stories and more are told in the Disgraceland podcast, hosted by me, Jake Brennan, every Tuesday, where I dive deep into subjects from the dark side of music history and entertainment. So follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do this Chris Herney deal. Chris Herney joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
That is The Grand Tour by George Jones, where he gives you the listener tour of the family home that he and his wife once lived in. And it is one of the great divorce songs in music history.
All right, well, we're here to talk about the Grizzlies divorce from Taylor Jenkins, obviously. And as you wrote... Not a surprise that it happened, but a surprise when it happened.
Not a surprise to me, not a surprise to Drew, not a surprise to some other people around the team, because we've been talking about it for a few weeks. But I think it's now taken on of like, everyone saw this. I don't think everyone saw this coming, but I think around the league it was a big surprise to a lot of people. But I think internally or around the team it had become a growing conversation, at least on the fringes, for the past several weeks. To the point that, and I told this story on the podcast that Drew and I recorded over the weekend, at one point on the road trip, midway through the road trip, Drew called me and said, "Do you think they're about to do it?" And I said, I said, "No, it's March." I don't remember what date it was. It was like March 22nd, March 23rd. I said, "A coach of a playoff team's never been fired on March 23rd. It's too late. They'll wait till after the playoffs." And he was like, "I don't know." And he was right. They did it.
Well, I spilled the beans and told the people in the first segment that Drew had the story pre-written.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about when he called.
Yeah.
About whether to have something ready.
Yeah. It doesn't mean, you know, whatever. So, all right. So then the next question is, why? Now. Why now?
Well, there's the why and there's the why now.
Okay.
I think we've pushed ahead and taken the why for granted. Everyone knew this was coming. I don't think that's true. The why now, I think if it was headed in this direction, my assumption was, even as of the day before this happened, or 5 minutes before this happened,
right.
My assumption was it's too late in the season. Things are trending in the direction of a coaching change, but it's too late to do it right now. And so you're going to go through the playoffs. My assumption was always, from beginning of the season, I wrote a column about this, the whole Taylor Jenkins on the hot seat thing. And it was clear that this was a make or break kind of season for Taylor Jenkins before the season ever started. But my assumption once we got to March was you're going to get through the postseason and then you're going to take a look at everything and make a decision. And playoff performance would be part of the decision. And I thought the decision would be a coaching change. But if they reached the point, which they clearly did, where they decided we're making a coaching change and nothing that will happen from now through April or May is going to change that, that we're making a coaching change, period. And even if they got hot and went on a run and got to the second round of the playoffs, whatever, we're still making a coaching change. If the decision is finally made, then at that point, I guess go ahead and do it, right? Like, what's the point at that point? So I get that. I just think it... I think the decision they were likely to make reached a certain point over the course of probably that road trip. Like, I don't think it was Oklahoma City game, but I think they were trending in this direction and things had gotten so so bad in terms of the defense, in terms of the ability to beat decent teams, and now the ability to beat mediocre teams when you're losing, you know, to Sacramento and you're losing to Portland. And I just think it felt like probably to the decision makers that the bottom was falling out of it, and there was no way that it was going to turn around to the point where you kept Taylor Jenkins. So if you have now decided you're just doing this, why delay it when you've already made the decision?
So clearly, pretty clearly, like, if the bottom weren't falling out in terms of performance, this wouldn't have happened. Whatever's happening with the assistants or behind the scenes or with Ja or whatever else.
It might have still happened in the summer, by the way.
Right. It might still happen. But had they not gone 0-10 against the 500 teams, recent 500 or above teams, then the defense had plummeted. This wouldn't have happened.
The patience of wanting to get through the season and get through the playoffs and then take it all in and make a determination, that patience disappeared.
Okay.
Right.
But let's then go. So it's performance based. That seemed to be the driver, but then it gets the question of more broadly why at the end of the season or what had gone wrong. What were the internal dynamics that were such that played into this decision that he wouldn't be the coach going forward?
I think there's so much focus on the offensive stuff, which we can get into, and that's important in part because of thinking about the usage of Ja Morant and Zach Edey and what they mean to the franchise. And it's important in terms of some, I think, misinformation that's gotten out there in the national reporting that probably more people around the country certainly have heard than ours, that I think is kind of giving people the wrong impression on some things. But the problem for the Grizzlies was not offense. Primarily, it was defense. Right. That's what drove their poor performance. And defense is, you know, partly talent and scheme, but it's also partly effort. And consistency of effort, consistency of focus. And that tends to be a reflection of coaching, right? That's one of the, when you're trying to figure out whether guys are good coaches or not, one of the first things people look at is defense. And the Grizzlies have been good defensively historically under Taylor Jenkins, and now there was dropping hard. And yeah, there's a talent issue there, but you could see it on the floor, just the effort lag, the focus lag, the intensity lagged. And for the team not in the height of the high point of a playoff race to have, I've been using the word casual for a month. They look casual in the first half. They look casual in that stretch. Then they got it going. They won in overtime or double overtime against Phoenix. But why are they in that standpoint? Because they're, like, not playing hard enough or focused enough in the first half. The intensity and the focus was just not there with any consistency. And I think that was taken as a reflection partly of, like, Jenkins had lost his grip. His voice was not being heard as much. It's not that you don't have to, like, dislike the coach. Right. Or have a bad relationship with the coach, or even want the coach fired. But at some point, it feels like the motivational stuff that a head coach needs to do to get guys to play hard consistently is just not happening.
Yeah.
And after 6 years, I think there was maybe a sense, fairly or not, I think there was a sense of maybe it's time for a new voice.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting distinction that I talked a little bit on the first hour. Sometimes when people hear lost the locker room, they hear the players didn't like him or resented him or turned on him. And the truth of the matter is one of the things...
There's no evidence of that I can see.
One of the things that struck me, was how much the fringe players who had been elevated by Scottie Pippen Jr., Jalen, like the guys who had been given his chance to, they adore him.
Right.
And Jaren and Dez clearly adore him. Jaz less so, it seems like. But Jaren and Dez both... So you can love them all you want, but lose it... That's not the same as reacting well
still
to his...
Are you still motivated by the coach? Do you still believe in the coach as a coach?
Right.
Which is not the same thing as believing in him as a person.
Or are you even just still playing hard under his direction? That's really it. They weren't. Right?
When he's telling you this is the approach, do you believe in it? Do you have faith in what's coming down? All of that kind of stuff. And frankly, 6 years is a long tenure for an NBA head coach.
This isn't some shock, right? The new voice is the effort.
Right. Now, this happens. I mean, I've been using, and I was reticent about, like, tying the knot on it because, frankly, the readers and listeners could tie it themselves without me pounding the table about it. But I've been using this Cleveland example all season of a team that... That broke through with a core not dissimilar from the Grizzlies core this season and that seemed to be hitting its head against a certain ceiling and could have broken it up and instead tweaked around it and kept working what they had until it got to a better place. And that is an example of, like, the Grizzlies shouldn't let go of that as what they could be, you know, still. And implicit in that was a coaching change was the big thing that sort of got them there.
Right.
Now, there's no guarantee that a coaching change gets you there, that's for sure.
Right. Okay. But it is interesting. Like, the national talking point is all about been this this assistant stuff,
right,
as connected with the offense.
It's easy to misunderstand because the story being told about it, and I don't think people are telling the wrong story on purpose. They've literally just legitimately like have taken these pieces and put them together, I think, quite slightly right. The wrong way. But the story being told is a good story, and it sounds like the truth. The problem is that it's not actually the truth.
Right. What's your view of the truth?
I think that this is way complicated. I'll try to narrow it because I know we don't have all day. So the Grizzlies, obviously last season was a mess, and that's not really on Taylor Jenkins. But there was a sense that the offense just has to get better. I think there was a sense internally that the coaching processes throughout the staff, and again, I don't want to denigrate other assistant coaches, but the staff that Jenkins had put together, I think organizationally they looked at and said, we could do better than this in terms of our preparation, in terms of our development, in terms of our strategic approach, etc. We could have a stronger staff. So I do think that suggested some diminished faith in Taylor Jenkins from the jump. But there was the idea of I think it was organizational fiat to get rid of most of your previous coaching staff. But in terms of assembling the new staff, I do think that was collaborative. And so the idea is we're going to put together a new staff, we're going to change our player development approach, we're going to change our strategic approach on our offense, try to upgrade our offense. So they go out, they hire Noah LaRoche to run their player development program.
Right.
Now, it happens that he brings with him a novel offensive philosophy that had been applied in Division III and smaller places. And then later on in the summer, they hired Thomas Isalo. I'm going to – the pronunciation, I'm sure, is all over the place for everybody.
Thomas
Isalo. Isalo? Okay.
That's him saying it.
All right. There we go. Thomas Isalo. So they go out and hire him, and he had been the head coach of a team in Paris in the EuroLeague that had the best offense, like, ever in European right. basketball, right? Right? So a winning head coach noted for his offense, right? So they bring him in, too. And the idea was you're going to take in these different elements along with what you already have and build something new that was going to make the Grizzlies' offense better. My impression from the jump, though, was that the LaRoche thing, yeah, he had his philosophy, but he was there to run the player development program. That was the main thing. And that the offense they wanted to lean to was more the Isalo offense. And the difference is that the LaRoche, there's some commonalities, but the difference is that the LaRoche thing was the we're going to maintain space. That was the, we're not doing screens. We're not doing dribble handoffs. We're not bringing players together. We're keeping them apart.
Right.
And so it's one-on-one drives and then orchestrated cuts. And when the players drive or cut, players move into the open space and you keep the space, right? That's not really how the Isalo teams played, as I understand it. His was more heavy pace, heavy attack, but using picks and screens as part of that. And he was known as sort of an innovator. It wasn't simple, just high screen and roll.
Right.
He was using screens and picks in sort of, more complicated ways to get players free. So the idea is you have all this stuff. You're Taylor Jenkins. You have these new people. You have these new concepts. You're trying to put it all together. You got lots of new jargon, which we heard all the time, collective basketball and advantage creation. We had a whole the three P's right. and all this stuff, right? And so my understanding from the jump was that LaRoche has his ideas, but he's there to really upgrade the player development. That was his main job. And the Isalo is more what we want to do. And the tell from that is like going out and drafting Zach Edey and then make it a big
right.
thing about like, Edey and Job. We've seen this before with these guys. It's going to be great. Remember the first preseason game against Utah where Edey's setting screens like 30 feet from the basket and Scottie Pippen's launching off the screens. Everyone's like, this is going to look great when it's John Moran right. instead. So I think the idea was the Isalo stuff would really fit the personnel a little bit. And Jenkins went hard into the LaRoche stuff. Now, the idea from the jump, which he said in training camp, and I've talked about in the show repeatedly, was the idea was always to bring the other stuff back in and reintegrate it. I think there was some frustration at going hard in the one more the one direction than the other, and then how long it took to reintegrate the other stuff. So I think there was some frustration about all of that from the organization. There seemed to be some frustration about that with John Morant. I think all that fed into it. I think that was not the main thing. The main thing is the defense and the commitment and the effort. But what people have gotten confused in some places nationally is that what the organization wants offensively based on this coaching change.
Right.
Where people have said, they got rid of people. Some people correctly noted they started to run more screens and pick and roll the last month, which we've talked about right. in the show. And some people said, you know, that's Taylor Jenkins going back to the old stuff, and management is upset about it.
Yeah, right.
And they got rid of him, and they were saying, no, we're going back to this other thing. And then some people have said, you know, the fact that they elevated this interim coach, Thomas Asalo, you know, they're doubling down on this new offense, and it's all wrong. Because the stuff that people have talked about, people have written stories about all over the country about this innovative Grizzlies offense, was not quite the Thomas Asalo offense. And so the firing Jenkins, firing LaRoche, making Asalo the interim is not a sign of wanting to go away, of wanting to return to what they did in the early part of the season. It's not a sign of wanting to continue to move away from a John Morant-oriented offense. It's the opposite of those things. And I think the use of Edie is maybe – Ja's more important than Edie, but in terms of like where they were headed and how they were going to use their talent and how they're headed, I think the Edie stuff was actually pretty important.
Yeah, you asked him about that, about sort of – or he was asked generally.
I don't think that was my question.
One question was just generally, what part of the offense – was yours, and then your question was.
I had a few questions, but
yeah, the question that I was referring to is about playing all these players.
Well, that's the other component of this, and I'm going to write about. I included it in my column from the game night, but I'm going to get back into that at some point if I can. We don't have much time left. I thought his answer was great. His answer was a lot of self awareness there, but the idea that. The idea that everything you didn't like about Taylor Jenkins now changes is, like, just not true.
Right.
Like, because this is an exchange I had with Taylor Jenkins, like, 1 week into the season about – the Grizzlies were already a team that played fast, that played a deep rotation, and that played lower minutes for starters than other teams. That was true. That's been true for 5 years.
Right.
They leaned more heavily into all three of those things going into this season. And I started asking Taylor Jenkins about that 1 week in. And my read on that all season has been, this works against the bad teams. It doesn't work against the good teams. You're not wearing down the good teams. I think that's been a problem all season. So I asked Thomas Asalo the same question I had asked Taylor Jenkins 1 week into the season. I thought his articulation his acceptance of the question and his articulation and framing of the different issues involved in the question was the best response. It was by far the best response. But he still did it. In the game.
Right.
He still did the same thing.
And the essence of the answer was what?
What he said was, yes, you can play your stars heavier minutes and maybe you get bang from your buck that way. I'm paraphrasing. Another approach is you spread the minutes out more and that allows you to play with more pace and more intensity, and that pace and intensity becomes a competitive advantage. I think that was the philosophy from the jump, and that's Jenkins had already played that way, and he played lean more, and that was more Asalo than LaRoche. I think it hasn't worked. And what Asalo said was, he said, you know, you can do it this way, or there's these two ideas. He said, but one thing I know, if you play your stars less and you don't play with more intensity than the other team, it won't work.
Right.
And if you can't play with more intensity, then I guess you're going to need to play your stars more. And what my response, and you get one question, then the microphone goes to someone else. If this were a back and forth, my follow up would have been, hasn't that been the case this season against the good teams, right? So, I mean, he's not installing his own stuff from scratch right now. He's taking over, so I don't know how much it'll change. If he were starting from scratch, I think he would still try to do the 11-man rotation and all this and get more intensity than Taylor Jenkins got. But I think that's been the story of this season, and that's one of the reasons I'm not ready to completely let go of the rope of them being competitive in the playoffs, because they haven't played playoff basketball.
Right.
They just don't do it, and so they're going to start doing it.
One of the things sort of in the midst of all this is that there has been a perception, which I think has been largely true, that management, Taylor Jenkins, they're a lockstep organization.
No.
And they very clearly have not been, right?
That's how
we viewed them. And it's very clear they have not been, and this year have not been. And that's a part of this, right? I think.
Yeah. I think, you know, in terms of, like, you talk about the voice, the coaching voice within the locker room, that voice goes in all kinds of different directions. Like,
right.
There's, like, the communication relationship, do you between management and coach of, like, you know, do you get tired of each other's voice a little bit? Do you lose faith in each other a little bit? It could be a two-way street. Only one side can fire the other, but that doesn't mean it's not a two-way street.
Right.
I think there's some of that. I think even, you know, around the organization. Jenkins is a really good guy, and he had a really successful run. And I made a point, the first column I wrote in my car, at the firing, my last sentence of that column was like, Taylor Jenkins' first coaching job will not be his last.
Of course.
That's the other way, to me, it's like this Cleveland situation, is that they fired a good coach, and that coach went on and got another job, and he's done fabulous in Detroit for that job.
Right.
I think that's what's going to happen with Taylor Jenkins. I think Taylor Jenkins will be the J.B. Bickerstaff of this situation. The question is, will Tuomas Isalo or anyone else be the Kitty Atkinson? And that's the real question.
On the Joss stuff, you don't believe, you know, immediately we saw he returned Saturday, and the conspiracy theorists are, well, he came back.
It was Murray State night.
Was it Murray State night?
Yes, it was Murray State night against the Lakers. No, he didn't suddenly spring into action against Taylor Jenkins and got fired. He was planning to play that game.
Do you think that, what do you think his unhappiness, what role do you think played in this?
Oh, I think it played a role. I think it plays a role in everything, and that's the issue that's frankly bigger than Taylor Jenkins and bigger than everything else, is like having Ja in a good frame of mind and a good frame of body.
Right.
That is the overarching thing with the whole franchise, and that might be a problem if you can't get it for more than 40 games a season or whatever. You know, that's a real issue. I think this is a lot of people reading into stuff. I wrote a big column about Ja. Like, he had that game against the Knicks where they got blown off the floor, and you can see him passing the ball and going to stand in the corner and almost huffing, and he was demonstrably unhappy when he was off the ball in that game. And then the very next game, he's sitting there on the bench with, like, you know, I call it the balaclava. I don't know what the shiesty, whatever the lingo has got over his head, and I wrote about that. At that moment, I wrote the concern about Morant, which had been building to that point. Now, it's hard to pick apart the different stuff because, frankly, I think there is different stuff there. There's the health stuff, which is nothing to do with Taylor Jenkins. I think he's been banged up. He's been annoyed that he's been banged up. He's been annoyed about the officiating. None of that's anything to do with Taylor Jenkins. My understanding is he's had some, like, personal family stuff or whatever that's, like, gotten him down, which just happens to people in life, you know? And that, you know, it's not everything's about basketball. These are human beings, and maybe that's been part of it. But I do think there was, and again, he has never said this, so people are reading it or secondhand or whatever, but I think it's generally a correct read. That to some degree, the offense sort of diminished the centrality of him, and that he didn't love that, and he didn't feel quite as comfortable in what he was supposed to be doing all the time. I think there's probably a lot of truth to that, too.
So what do you make of what we saw Saturday, and what do you expect it to look like going forward?
It looked like a game that, like, for the most part, that could have been coached by Taylor Jenkins. It was more of the same, right? You know, I mean, in terms of, for the most part, how the roster was used and what the outcome was and what the problems were. It was very similar. Like, the defense was not sharp enough in the first half, and they get down big, and then they tighten it up, and they fight back, and they get in the game. But you're playing uphill, and we've seen across, this is NBA basketball, man. It's hard to play uphill for 30 minutes and get to the mountaintop, and that's sort of what happened. You know, they move Zach Edey back in the starting lineup. Would Taylor Jenkins have done that? Probably not. Is this something that Isalo will do? Is this a permanent change? I think it probably is, but I'm not exactly certain about that because he talked about some of the matchup stuff. But I think a re-emphasis on using Zach Edey was one thing that I thought was different. I do think it bit him, and I'm going to pray to the basketball gods that he ignores this and goes the opposite direction. He treated the Jaren foul stuff differently than Taylor Jenkins would have. Jaren got two fouls in the first half, and if Taylor Jenkins were coaching, Jaren would not have started the second quarter on the floor.
Right.
Isalo started with Jaren back in. I said, yes. And Jaren immediately got a third foul, and he took him out for the rest of the quarter, and then he finished the game with four fouls. And I don't want Isalo to say, oh, I messed up putting Jaren back in. I want him to say, I messed up taking him out after the third. Keep playing him.
Right.
Play him. Win the game. Try to win the game. Ignore the fouls. Try to win the game. Because, frankly, Jaren was the best player on the floor in the second half of that game.
Right.
And if they had ignored the fouls and he had played 34 minutes instead of 24 or whatever it was, they might have won that game. So, but the fact that he treated that differently, I enjoyed. I hope there's more of that. But for the most part, it didn't look that different. It was not a case of the players came out on fire because of the coaching change. That was not the case at all. And Isalo said before the game, like, not much is going to change. And Ja said after the game, like, you know, this happened on an off day, and we have an hour for shoot around, and, like, here we are. And so from a strategic standpoint, it's hard to change a lot of that. Now, it's easy to change the minute stuff, and he didn't do that for the most part because I think the minute stuff is his philosophy. But he also said before the game, I'm a pragmatist. I want to do whatever's going to get us the best net rating. And to me, that's the real test of him, not only now, but if they keep him going forward. Because I am not convinced that his approach in total that was so successful in Europe will be so successful in the NBA. I think his offensive philosophy stuff is probably fine. In fact, it may be great. But I think the extreme pace with the extreme rotation stuff, I just don't believe it'll work in the NBA. And I would like to say it would, because I grew up on Nolan Richardson basketball.
Right.
40 minutes of hell, deep rotations, heavy minutes, quick substitutions.
You do that when your players aren't as good as the other team's players.
That's right. This is what I'm saying. I agree.
That's what you do.
And also it requires a defensive intensity that you can hold across the core of the game, and that has not happened this season. I'm not sure it will. So I believe in a fast-paced basketball. I don't believe I think they should pull back on that. I'm more like, you know, not to be like the old man rolling at clouds, but like the old Hubie Brown ball, man. They played fast, but like, and they played a deep rotation, but it wasn't as extreme. They got after it.
Right.
Even Taylor Jenkins 2 or 3 years ago, that team played a pretty deep rotation. They played fast, but it wasn't like they weren't insisted on being the fastest team in the league. They insisted on substituting every 3 or 4 minutes so that guys can stay fresh. The insistence on playing 11 people right. instead of 9 or whatever. I think I would just pull back 10% on some of that stuff, and I think you'd get better results.
So do you think, and the last question here, though, I'm going to let you go, do you think this is an audition?
Yeah, I think to a degree, because I think if he were going to – If he were 100% certain to be the head coach, he would probably already be the head coach and not the interim head coach. But I don't think this is a case of, well, it's too late in the season to bring somebody new in and we got to play out the string. It's not Tony Barone,
right?
Who was never going to be the permanent head coach.
Right.
I do think there is a good chance that they keep Isolo going into next season. But I think that plan can change based on, not just on the record, but based on the sense of like, how he handles things for the rest of the season and through the whatever postseason they have. But it is notable, like, he was a successful head coach.
Right.
This is not some, like, hotshot assistant. He has been a head coach with great success. It was not in the NBA, but there's been a pattern over the years of people being successful head coaches in other pro leagues, whether that was the CBA or that was Mike D'Antoni in Europe or other places. Like, he has been a successful head coach.
And I don't know if it'll translate, but the pace of his talking is definitely different than the...
I joked about that. Taylor Jenkins practiced what he preached in terms of pace in the post-game, pre-game press conferences. I do think there's an element of... I don't know. There's a difference between what like I respond to as a media person sitting there and how players respond in huddles and in practice and in the locker room. And the second thing is way more important than the first thing, obviously.
Right. Yeah,
I felt like... I mean, I like Taylor Jenkins a lot, but like the combination of like coaches clinic and business seminar stuff is just not the way it's just not my personality at all. It's like the opposite. So I was not like rah-rah about all of that. But I also think there was an element with Jenkins, as successful as he was, of there's an element of sort of self-doubt to me in there of this is a guy who had never played post-high school and sort of came in this. He felt like he was trying to sort of prove himself a lot. And Isolo seemed like extremely comfortable in his skin in the way he answered things. And I was intrigued by that. Whether that's going to work with the players, I don't know. But I thought I was very impressed with the quality, both the quality of his answers before and after the game and the sense of composure and sort of comfort that he gave.
And I was also impressed by in the locker room, like, again, Des very clearly really likes Taylor Jenkins and Jaren really likes, and yet the word that everybody uses is really like clearly respect the basketball mind of Isolo. You know, they've everyone talks about how smart he is.
So we'll see. But is that what they need? Is that, could that be what they need with some assistant coaches who bring some different qualities?
Right.
Like these are all things that I'll put it this way on the pod. The front, Isolo, if they were an expansion team or if they were starting to rebuild, I think Isolo would be the head coach. They have to acknowledge that that is not what they're doing. They're not starting from scratch, putting in a program.
Right.
It is go time going into next season, and they have to have a coach that's going to motivate and manage the personalities and maximize the star players they have. And that might be Tuomas Isolo, but it has to be that. It can't be who is our ideal basketball mind, basketball coach, you know, in a vacuum. It has to be who's going to get the most out of this team right now. That has to be the way they think about it.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Folks, go listen to the pod. I mean, after we're done here. Go listen to the pod over at the Daily Memphian. Drew and Chris, if you haven't listened to it before, this would be a fine time to dive in. Robert Owen Jewelers in Bartlett having a six-hour, 60% off sale this Saturday. That's right, a six. It's a kind of amazing. Six-hour, 60% off. That's Saturday, April 5th at the Bartlett location. It's right there at the corner of Bartlett Boulevard and Stage Road, right next to the Kroger. And this means that everything in the store, 60% off, everything in the showcase, they only have the sale every once in a while. This is now they're doing it in Bartlett. So it's 60% off engagement rings, 60% off bracelets and earrings and necklaces and gemstones and brand name watches, 60% off all of that for 6 hours only, starting at 10 a.m. at the Bartlett location this Saturday. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. It's Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. It's time to get yourself to Oak Hall. I'm going to go to Oak Hall either today or tomorrow. I got to go to Oak Hall because I'm looking a little shabby in terms of my spring and summer stuff. And right now, this would be the perfect time. Get yourself ready. You walk on in there. And whether you're getting ready for backyard barbecues or vacation or spring weddings or whatever it is, this is the moment. Stunning clothes and the same folks who've been there all year long. They help you get ready for spring and summer. I recommend a new sport coat, new spring sport coat. Oh, nothing makes you feel better than a, but they got, I mean, they got the, all the stuff from Faraday and Peter Millar and the swimwear. You walk in there and you'll know it's spring and summer and it is time to get ready. Go see our friends at Oak Hall. All right, Jeffrey, a couple thoughts on what Chris Harrington said. Maybe we got to talk briefly. It is kind of amazing. Here we are, the Final Four is set, and we aren't even going to have much time to talk about it at all. I thought his point about the next coach was interesting. That if they were starting from scratch, they'd just hired, you know, they'd just taken over, they just drafted Ja, right? And given the universe of possible coaches, I think Tomas Isalo would be the person they would hire, right? Don't you think?
That seems likely, yes.
And no one seems to doubt his quote-unquote basketball mind, right?
No one doubts his bona fides, yeah.
But this is, as Chris said, go time. How much of what the next coach should be capable of doing is, let's be honest, coaching what is now a veteran team, and honestly, getting the best out of Ja. Like, in the end, whatever happens around the three stars this summer in terms of personnel, the three stars are still going to drive this, right? And this team started to go off the rails the moment Ja picked up the gun in Denver, right? You know what I mean? Like, ever since. And it's been complicated. It's been injury, and it's been like lots of stuff has happened. But
I think you can make the argument things started to really go off the rails, though, when the Indiana Pacers incident.
You could argue then, yeah. But so it's like,
it was unavoidable.
Again, I'm not worried about it. It is interesting. Like, even like I asked Ja a question Saturday. I said, so is this a moment when, you know, and it's because we had heard about this players only meeting that they had called, right? And so I just said, so was this a moment when, you know, you, Jaron and Dez, you know, have to emerge and provide leadership in this critical moment? Something like that was the question. And Ja's like, who else would you think would do it? Like, it wasn't like, it was immediately defensive. And then I said, well, no, I just heard that you had a players-only meeting and it was important and you're, you know. He said, yeah, well, and no matter what we say is you're going to say we're terrible leaders. Not you, but people are going to say, people out there, it doesn't matter what I say. He just is so intrinsically defensive. He has this enormous, like, the question wasn't, there was nothing implying anything negative and contained in that question at all. It was just like, how great a leader are you, Ja? And it was, he is in such a defensive place right now, defensive posture. The world is out to get him. Everybody's out to get him. The officials are out to get him. I do think, I don't know, like someone like he needs a strong coach, someone who's going to lay down the law to Ja, right? Well, that may be exactly the wrong thing with Ja.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, that could make him check out. Yeah,
it could make him like check out the mandatory, whatever else.
Yep.
Like, could so, but you also don't someone who Ja's going to walk over.
Yep.
You don't want that either. So you want someone that will reach Ja, right? That can effectively coach Ja and get the best out of Ja. I feel like you're going to probably get the best out of Dez and Jaren because they're going to show up and be their best, right?
Yeah. They seem to be less susceptible to
everything.
Yes.
Literally everything. So now I'm sure some, you know, want a high profile, right? And I'm not saying that's not, you know, you look at the quote unquote names out there. I guess Mike Brown is probably one of the biggest names out there, right?
It seems to be the big name. I mean, I assume there could be some more shifting after this year, but Mike Brown seems to be the one that is available.
Yeah. And then beyond that, what are your hopes for the rest of the season? What's the best thing that could happen? What's the best scenario?
We enjoy watching the games again.
That's what I wrote about Saturday. There was a moment. It wasn't a very encouraging game Saturday. Let's be honest, from a Grizzlies perspective, they made a run, but I never thought they were going to win. And but at the end of in the second half, they Ja goes coast to coast for that reverse. You know, whatever. And
yep.
Then the next trip down, misses a shot. Zach Edey has been thrust back into the starting lineup, puts back Grizzlies lead, places loud. I'm looking around. I'm like, this is what FedEx Forum is supposed to feel like. I don't, I've been looking for the bottom to drop out for the last 2 weeks. I've been fearful that they were going to be in the play-in for the last 2 weeks. I still think they're going to be in the play-in, even though the odds are, you tell me,
79%.
And Matt tells me that they won't be. They are right now a game up on Golden State. They're a game up on Golden State. They're a game and a half up on Minnesota. Now, they have the tiebreaker over Minnesota. And they are two up on the Clippers. Warriors won last night. Clippers lost last night. Cleveland did the Grizzlies a solid there. So, but for me, it's play well over these last eight games without drama or anything other than highly competitive basketball, right?
Yeah.
Win five or six of them.
Yeah.
Right? Go in and have a playoff series. Maybe you'll be four. Maybe you'll be five. Maybe you'll be six. But have a hammer and tong. Go at it hard, competitive playoff series where your fans are enraged, where after wins they're playing whoop that trick, where we are reminded how much fun Grizzly basketball is without any of the crap and drama and whatever that has felt like has been a part of this franchise for the last 2 years, right?
Yeah.
Like, just if he can deliver that and create, by the way, some momentum heading into next year, some sense that we have righted the ship and that it is fun. I can't tell you how many people are like, I have season tickets. I'm not sure I'm going to get them next year. Right? Like, and then so people say that and then they get them anyway. And I hope they do get them because I want this franchise to flourish. But have a ending that restores momentum, restores a sense of possibility and fun, and is fundamentally without drama, angst, miserable, pouting, any of that nonsense. That, to me, is the best thing that could happen. And that doesn't even require winning a first-round playoff series. You can do that if you make the playoffs and have a seven-game series and you lose in a heartbreak, whatever else. Winning a first-round series, that would go a long way to restoring momentum. But if they can do that, I'd be happy.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's just like, it's as simple as just make us not dread turning the games on.
Right. Make us look forward to the next
Correct.
Grizzly game. Make us look forward to the next Memphis Grizzly game. All right. Kyle and Amanda were selling their house. They were ready, you know, they actually live in Bartlett. And family's growing, all of that. And selling your house can be daunting. So what they did is they called Josh Hysaw from Keller Williams Realty, and he comes over and he says, you know what we're going to do? I'm going to tell you what the market value is for your home. I'm going to make you a cash offer for your home. That way, you don't have to fix it up. Don't have to get it ready to sell. Don't have to list it. Don't have the suspense of listing it. Don't have to clean it up every time someone wants to come and look at the house over the next 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months if it's sitting there on the market. Nope. And so that's what they did. Accepted the cash offer. Boom. Get 4 months to move. Happy. Kyle and Amanda thrilled with Josh Hysaw and the team at Keller Williams Realty. That's among the things that Josh Hysaw can do for you. Phone number is 901-461-8147, 901-461-8147. Josh Hysaw is the person to trust if you need or want to sell your home. You can call him, or the website is joshhasthebuyers.com. Back in a moment, Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Your thoughts on the Final Four, Jeffrey? God, we couldn't talk about anything else.
Obviously, people are going to connect the all four number one seeds to the 2008 Final Four, also in San Antonio, with four number one seeds.
Yep.
I actually thought, though, this tournament was more reflective of the tournament the year before that in 2007, which was the year where we had a ton of chalk, but instead of four ones, we had, I think it was two ones and two twos. But in general, like, when I think about that tournament, I remember that Florida won again. Like, that was their second of the back-to-back.
Yep.
But I have very little recollection of beyond much. I think that was the tournament where Memphis beat A&M in the Sweet 16. And then did Ohio State beat them in that Elite Eight? But, like, I just have very...
Ohio State beat them? Yeah, I think that's right.
I think Ohio State beat them in the Elite
Eight. Rank the four teams remaining.
I think Duke is the number one team, but I do think it's a fascinating matchup where you have the young team that has all the talent with the team against the grown men that, and, you know, one's the number one offense, one's the number one defense. Like, that's an interesting style. I still think Florida's played around with their food probably a little too much, but it still feels to me like they have the second most. And so I think I would go Duke 1, Florida 2. I guess I give Auburn 3, Houston 4. But, like, I do feel like you can tell me a scenario where any one of these four teams wins, and I can map it out.
You think they played it 100 times, all the teams would win a certain number?
Yeah, I think. And obviously maybe not some would win more than others, but I think they could play it a bunch of different ways.
And how should Tennessee fans feel about their season and that game?
I mean, I know everyone wants to jump to the Rick Barnes stuff.
I mean, in the end, like, let's be honest, wouldn't Memphis Tiger fans sign up for it?
I mean, you made the elite. I guess
my biggest problem
was, though, is I don't think the Rick Barnes stuff applies to the last two tournament exits.
Right.
I think they went up against better teams and got beat.
Right.
Now, does that absolve other years where they did have disappointing performances? No, but I didn't feel like that was what it was yesterday. Yeah. And Chaz Lanier looked like they didn't have these guys at UNF.
Very clearly. Spazzed out in the first half. They played him pretty even in the second half, but when you dig that deep of a hole, yeah. Anyway, all right. What's coming up next on 92.9?
Jeff, here's what's coming up next on Jason and John. Today they will be joined by Jeff at 1:25. Coach Hurd will be with me today on Jeff Wright and Company. Jason Munns joins us at 2:35. Kyle will be with Gabe at 5 o'clock.
Thanks for listening, buddy. We got to get out of here. Back tomorrow for now. Work is done.